Right, capitalism's big, beautiful pyramid scheme and the price of freedom. I want to talk about this is a kind of experimental talk. It's based on a number of things I've been kind of playing with recently, doing some reading. I want to talk about four quite separate things. I want to talk about property. I want to talk about equality and the lack of equality. I want to talk about rights, the whole concept of rights, and I want to talk about the notion of freedom. And each one of those, you could probably do about 12 different talks on. So this is kind of a very kind of high level overview of those different concepts and how they relate to one another. It's the way they relate to one another that I'm kind of interested in here, and how particularly equality, freedom, and the whole kind of language of rights relates to property. And this may not be of any particular value to you as a kind of, when you're kind of educating for the socialism, unless of course you spend your time online talking to capitalist apologists with sort of academic and very often pseudo-academic sort of approach to the attempt to justify the current system. But I think it's interesting, and I think it's sort of like any kind of background information. At least personally, I find any kind of background information, this kind of stuff, quite useful to sort of as a base in which to sort of think about the whole socialist case. So I'm going to start with property. And I've talked a lot about property before in earlier lectures, and we've discussed it here on the forum. And we know that there was a point in history in sort of late Paleolithic, early Neolithic times, 10, 12,000 years ago, when property didn't exist within societies. The evidence is, it's not absolutely solid, but it gives us pretty good confidence that before that period, most societies, most human societies, lacked the institution of property. We obviously have property now, so it means that there was a point of transition between the two. And the question of how that transition came about or how it progressed, the answer to that question, the frank answer, is that we don't entirely know, because it all happened in pre-literate part of our history before we had written language. So we don't have any kind of clear records, but we have enough information to give us a kind of a way of putting together a broad idea of how it happened. And we can have sort of reasonable confidence in that. And what seems to be sort of pretty clear is that the rise of property came with the rise of agriculture in society. That in earlier times, in hunter-gatherer times, people lived in, so I'm sure you're getting sick of this phrase, immediate return societies. That is, they lived in societies where they provided for their needs day by day. They didn't store anything. They had no means of preserving food. They just ate what they produced on the day that they produced it, or more or less. And farming, of course, is a delayed return society. And what that actually means is that when farmers sort of labor, they don't get a return for months later. So they, for months, they put their labor into the land, but they don't get a return on it until months later. And so that return, of course, is like their life depends upon that return. But also they've had this long, long period where they've been working on the land to produce it. And so they acquire a certain protectiveness about it. They don't want somebody just casually coming in after their months of labor and just saying, "Oh, that's some nice corn there. I'll rip that away." So you begin to get this notion of the necessity, in a sense, of property, so that the goods that are produced are defended by people. Now, I've talked about the question of what property is before, and I hope you'll excuse me if I do it again, if you've heard this before, because there may be some people who haven't. But even if you have heard it before, I think it's such an important concept that it's well worth repeating and really getting kind of into your head what the nature of property is, because so much else depends upon it. Certainly, so much in the socialist case depends upon this notion of what property is. And the first thing that I would say is property is not a thing. We are so used to the idea that property consists of things that we get kind of, we actually forget what the nature of property is. Now, you can see into my room here, and you can see sort of objects all around, and you will assume that these objects are property. And for those of you who have your cameras on, I can see into your room, and I can see certain things that I would assume in your house to be your property. But property is not a thing. And we can see this very clearly. To take any kind of household object, I've got a CD here. And if we look at this object, we can describe it in various ways. It has a shape, has a weight, it has color, it has a smell, it's made of a certain kind of material. This is hinged. So we can describe it in all sorts of ways, but it doesn't matter how closely we scrutinize it. We won't find anything in this that says this is property, that this is somebody's property, because property is not a natural quality of objects. What property is a social relationship between people. It's an agreement, a tacit agreement that we're born into, actually, that we will treat certain objects in certain ways. That you will, I will treat this as my property. I will have certain rights over this property. I can control it in certain ways that you can't and you won't. That's our agreement. And your property is something that you can control in your ways and I can't. And if somebody breaks that agreement, then I'm going to be pretty cross and the law may come down on you, basically, if it can catch you for actually transgressing the rules of property. So it's an agreement. And we call it a social relationship. And that word social is quite important because it doesn't just mean the sort of I socialize with you and socialize with somebody else and you socialize with each other. It actually means that it's a relationship that is reflected right across society. And today, indeed, globally, it's a relationship that spans the world. And we can think of it as a kind of net, a network. You can imagine a net surrounding the world. And where the threads of the net cross, where they're knotted, that's a person with their property. And they're relating to all the other property, the people with this property. So it's actually a network. And you can imagine sort of objects like this or anything at all as kind of being trapped in this human network of property relations. But it's not only the objects that are kind of trapped into it, it's human beings as well. Because as an individual human beings, we are born into a property system. We don't, as individuals, evolve it or create it. We are born into it. We have no choice in we can transgress it, but there will be consequences if we transgress it. And most of us don't, at least most of the time, transgress these property relationships. So we are actually kind of trapped like these objects in this network of relationships. And so individuals can do nothing about it. The only way that this net can be frayed and disposed of is collectively. And that is so fundamental to our lives. We're educated about the nature of property from children, by our parents, when we go to shops, we're told not to touch that because you have to pay for it and all this kind of stuff. And this is reinforced through our education, through the media, and maybe just even through sort of films where we see the relationships constantly unfolding in front of us. Property has a number of consequences, and I kind of want to focus on two of them. Well, really, I just want to focus on one, but the other one needs just sort of kind of exemplifying to some extent. And one of the consequences of property is that it has to be enforced. It's not something that is just naturally there. Property, right from the start, has to be enforced. Violence and property go together. You know, if you look outside and you think about your daily experience, you're not going to sort of think, well, people aren't sort of, we're not punching each other in the face, stealing our stuff every day in the street. We accept the property relationships. We've internalized the necessity for these relationships. But just imagine for a moment, as if by some magical in some magical way, the legal system, the law courts, the law, the police force was suddenly to disappear. Okay. Clearly, what's something that's going to have consequences. And it may not be that the property system just simply collapses immediately. We are all trained in this, and we all recognize that if we're going to live in a property society, to tr constantly be transgressing that is going to cause chaos. But property, the objects of property, are essential to our lives, especially if you don't have a lot of money. We consume property, and therefore we actually have to constantly produce and consume it. So we have to constantly obtain it. And so if you get away rid of any kind of enforcement, then property relationships are going to be severely damaged. People are actually going to start transgressing them where they see they can get away with it. The second feature of property is that it creates inequality. And this is fundamental. It creates inequality in society. It's very simple. You have to have it when you have a property system, you have to have a system, a means of transferring objects from one object, owned objects from one person to another. And we do that in our society by means of economic exchange, by trade. We trade objects one for another or through the medium intermediary of money. Same thing, money is a kind of form of property as well. You own it or you don't. And so, in this process of exchange, things can go wrong. And they don't necessarily always trade at their value. That may not be things going wrong, that just may be the order of society. Things don't necessarily trade at their value. So objects of property can accumulate in some hands and not in others. And so you start to get a separation of a gradation of wealth. So you get today is today, you get the super wealthy and you get the impoverished and those on the point of starvation. That's a feature of property itself. It's an inevitable feature of property. To some degree, at any rate, it's an inevitable feature of property. And one of the interesting things about this is to question, well, why do we accept that? And we know for kind of quite obvious reasons why those at the top of the property pyramid, those with the most property, want to preserve it. Because in our society, in most societies, property translates to wealth, translates to power. Because if I have a lot of property and you have none, you are in my power. Because the only way that you can actually get property, which you need to survive, is through me. And in our society, that would be by selling your labor to me in order to actually obtain what you want. So property means power. And power, generally speaking, property, wealth, and power, generally speaking, also mean status. So that's a bundle that tends to go together. And that's kind of important for us. So those at the top obviously want to retain their wealth, power, and status. And so that's quite understandable why they would want to retain property. But it's not so easy to understand why those at the bottom want to retain this property system. Now, I'm sure you can all think of reasons why. Yeah, I mean, we have the ideological system, we have the media, we have education, which trains us into it. But at the bottom of the system, what you actually find through history is not only people that are prepared to accept it, but who are insist on vigorously supporting it. And that's kind of a little bit of a puzzle. And I think there are all kinds of reasons for that. People have advanced a number of reasons, so sort of psychological reasons, the simple fact that we kind of just take it for granted as human beings. We're born into it and it simply becomes the background of our lives and we don't think to question it. And for some people, they don't understand, well, for a lot of people, they don't actually understand the effect of the institution of property itself has upon their lives, so they don't think to question it. But it's very clear that although that is a kind of general situation, it's also clear that the issue of inequality, which property creates, is questioned very much in society. And one of the ways in which we know that is that throughout the history of property societies, people have strenuously tried to justify and provide justifications and explanations for this inequality. They've said it's inevitable. They have said it comes from our individual differences between us. Some of us are more intelligent than others. Some of us are more stronger than others. Some of us have skills, others don't. Some of us are disadvantaged in various ways. And some people say that it comes from our natural individual differences. But others have taken a different view. And what I want to look at here is there are two principal ways in which people down through the ages have attempted to justify property. One is by claiming that it's a result of an order of nature. It comes from nature itself. It's an order of nature that actually creates inequalities in our relationships. And the others say it's God. And these two are the two primary ways in which, down through the ages, people have justified property and more specifically, inequality. There are others. There are other ways. And within those two broad categories, there are lots and lots and lots of different explanations that have been given at different times. And those explanations are all contradictory to one another. So those contradictions themselves tell us that these explanations are not actually simple, truthful statements about the world, that they are, in fact, ideologies. They are ways that people have used to maintain inequality in the system, presumably for the advantage principally of those at the top of it, or those who aspire to the top of it, if their particular society allows them some route to get to the top. So I want to have a look at these two main ways, nature and God. And the earliest ways in which people justified it are through religious ideas. And it's a bit curious, actually, because there is a theory by anthropologists, and it's somewhat controversial, but there is sufficient evidence for it to for us at least to entertain it. And that is that religious ideas are traditionally of a kind that actually could and probably did, were used to justify egalitarianism and not inequality. Because if you look at a number of pre-propertarian societies, before property evolved, what you find is a kind of similar structure, a kind of similar belief system, a mythology. And that mythology says, okay, we're all here on Earth, and somewhere up there or over there or somewhere, there are spiritual beings above us, gods, whatever it is, tricksters, and sort of animate beings without a body. And these are all alphas and betas. And by that, what I mean by that, it's like by analogy to alpha males and beta males, the sort of people at the top of the sort of aggressive pyramid of force that you find in a lot of animal societies. So lots of those gods and spirits are alphas and betas. We down here are all gammas. So we're all at the bottom rung, and we're all kind of equal. Yeah. And in those societies, that kind of mythology tends to help to kind of hold society together. It's a myth that tends to hold egalitarian relations together. So how did this actually transform? Well, one way of actually understanding that is to look at we can't look at the very earliest societies where property was just beginning to develop and the inequality was beginning to develop because, as I said, they were all pre-literate societies. But we can look at small scale or relatively small scale societies that still exist today or did exist several hundred years ago and which we have knowledge of, which have actually do have a religious justification for inequality in their societies and indeed extreme inequality in their societies. And one of them, one of my favorites, is Hawaiian society as it existed in the late 18th century, sometime around the 1770s, when Captain Cook, who was engaged in his journey of exploration, was sailing around in the Pacific among the Polynesian islands. And he came across this society, and it was structured in a kind of interesting way. Like most, well, in fact, like all property societies have inequalities of wealth and power, etc. It had a very distinct pyramid shape. And right at the top of that pyramid was a paramount chief. Now, the paramount chief owned all the land, owned everything on his island. And beneath, and he also had absolute power of life and death over all the people else on the island. And beneath him, there were a layer of nobles. And beneath them, there were kind of like they kind of employed managers to look after their land. And also, there was a layer beneath them of peasants. And the paramount chief would kind of grant land to the nobles, who would then grant land to the peasants. And the justification for this system, as Cook found, was that the paramount chief was a direct descendant from an ancestor who was favored by the gods. So this direct ancestor had the divine essence, which had been passed down to the paramount chief. And the nobles also were descended from this ancestor, but not directly, but on collateral lines. So they had less of the divine essence. And then eventually below them, you had the peasants who had almost no divine essence at all, and who therefore were suited to being ordered about, and also who were suited to doing the labor in society. The paramount chief did no labor at all. He lived on the exclusively on the labor of others. So you see how this mythology is actually used to explain and to justify this inequality in society, which actually comes from the property relations in the society. And you can see how this might just have required the slightest of tweaks from this earlier idea, justifying egalitarianism, that there were all alphas and betas up there, because what the paramount chief is now saying is that one of those alphas up there in the heavens came down and favored my ancestor and passed their divine essence onto me. So you can see this is a kind of classic way in which ideologies can morph and change to justify very different systems at different times and different places. You don't, if a society sort of changes in its fundamentals, you don't actually need a whole new ideology. Very often you can just tweak the existing ideology very slightly, and it will be you can be used to justify something completely different, which is another way of kind of explaining that, you know, these things are just fancies, they're just creations of the mind or of society. And you find that this kind of pattern of relationship, this pattern of mythology to justify these relationships throughout the world. I'm going to be focusing on Western Europe because that's what I know and that's what I've read. But from my more extensive reading, you'll find the same kind of patterns around the world. So this is just as an illustration. So these patterns are repeated in the kind of early state societies in Mesopotamia, in Egypt, in the great river valleys, the Yangtze and the Yellow River in China, and in the Indus Valley. In sub-Saharan Africa, in Central and South America, wherever these very early state societies evolved, they evolved exactly the same, well, not exactly, but a version of this same mythology. You had a kind of the godhead was in fact the at the top of it. And this has persisted for a very this kind of mythology has persisted for a very long time. As I said, there are others which we'll look at briefly, but this is the one that has persisted. And what is really ironic is that when the West actually discovered the Hawaiian Islanders through Captain Cook, they found this whole thing about sort of the kind of favored ancestor a bit bizarre, without realizing that their own society had exactly the same mythology sort of related to it. We're going back to the 18th century now, so Britain was at that time, it was far from being a democracy. You had a king at the top. He was a constitutional monarch by this time, but he still had a great deal of power, and beneath him were the House of Lords. And so we had the same pyramid. And who justified the king? Well, he reigned by divine command, really. By that time, that argument, this idea that it was God who gave the king powers, something was just kind of like a story. That was kind of built into the constitution. So it wasn't something that people believed as a sort of in a literal sense, but it was still there as a pattern of justification in their minds, which actually helped to justify it for them. And even to this day, actually, the UK is actually a theocracy. Technically, in terms of its constitutional structure, it's a theocracy because the sovereignty of the House of Commons is granted to it by the reigning monarch. The reigning monarch has it granted to him by the crown, which was originally that sort of bauble, the glinty, bubbly bauble that sat on his head, which was endowed with mystical powers of sovereignty. But nowadays, actually, has been sort of it's been kind of tweaked slightly, and in fact, the crown is seen as basically the royal family, a corporation that grants the power to the reigning monarch, the one who is entitled to wear the crown. And where does the crown get it from? Well, he gets it from God. So basically, you've got the same kind of pattern of justification at some level within society, and we find that all over the place. So we've got that in sort of archaic societies. We've got that in early state societies. When we get to Greece and Rome, we see slightly different versions of it. The Greeks, for whatever reason, and personally, I don't actually understand why this happened. I need to research this a little more. But the Greeks were kind of interesting because they weren't the first, but they were the first to actually start to look at the natural world and try and explain the natural world rationally, in rational terms, without actually invoking the Godhead. So they actually looked to an order of nature to explain this inequality, and boy, did they believe that this inequality was natural. And you get a few anomalies. You get sort of like the Athenian democracy. But the Athenian democracy was a bit of a sham, really. It was really an oligarchy because it excluded most of the people in Athens. It excluded all women, of course, those creatures down there. Athens was not a good place to be a woman during the classical period. Okay, it excluded all slaves, of which there were a great many. It excluded all foreigners. It excluded people they call the Metics, who were kind of non-Greek residents of the city. So it actually involved only a very small part of the society. And although Greek democracy, Athenian democracy, did exist for a while, it was never very popular, and certainly not popular among those philosophers and political thinkers of the time. It was constantly attacked. So you get people like Plato and Aristotle, who were actually constantly attacking it. Aristotle, of course, is famous for his justification of slavery on the grounds that slaves, certain people, by their nature, were fit to be slaves. So this is an argument from nature rather than from God. Plato's a bit of an outlier on this because he did think women could rise to the position of being guardians. That was really a bit weird in classical Greek times, but he did suppose that. And he also wasn't into an aristocracy, which most of the rest were. He kind of proposed a kind of meritocracy. But generally speaking, here is the first kind of look at an ideology that is based on the order of nature. And then we get to medieval Europe. And things start to get really interesting at this point, because the justificatory mechanism was, of course, a Christian one. The Catholic Church in the West and the Orthodox Church in the East, these were the propaganda vehicles of the medieval world. These are the ones who actually pumped out the propaganda to keep people locked into their places. And the one of the really interesting things about Catholic doctrine, however, was that potentially in Catholic doctrine there is a very strong argument for egalitarianism if you promote it. And it's very simple that we are all the sons of God, God the Father, and as Jesus Christ is also the Son of the Father, we are all brothers in Christ. We are all brothers of Christ. So we are all equal before God. We have all have a moral equality. And the Catholic Church obviously was not going to promote this argument, because clearly the Catholic Church was the spokesperson, the ideological spokesman for a distinctly a pyramid-shaped hierarchy of wealth and of wealth and power. So what the Catholic Church did instead was it created this really peculiar circular argument. And its circular argument was, well, God has a plan for the world. And if we look around the world, we see that hierarchy exists. So this obviously and indeed must be part of God's plan. He either has contrived it that way, or at least he allows it. Therefore, we must accept it. We must accept the pyramid. We must accept the hierarchy, because that's the way God endowed it. And they also bolstered this by another argument, which they actually borrowed from the Greeks. It actually is not to be found in the Bible or in the history of Christian sort of sacred scripture. They borrowed from the Greeks the idea of the great chain of being, which lasted, has an amazing lasting power. It lasted for about 1,500 years as a way of justifying early and medieval inequality. And it's an immensely complex argument. It ramified all over the place. But in its basic simple elements, it's God is perfect, as we all know, and therefore God's creation is perfect. And a perfect thing must be a plenum, that is, it must be full. There must be no empty spaces in it. Why? Like all these kind of explanations, no justification is ever given. They are just presented as part of the mythos. And so within that plenum, everyone has a place. And those places are, of course, hierarchical. So there is a hierarchy of everything. There is a hierarchy with God at the top, and then coming down to man and everything. But there is a hierarchy of animals, there is a hierarchy of plants, there is a hierarchy of inanimate objects, there in that hierarchy of societies. Everything was part, and this was drawn out in immense detail. So like the right at the top of the hierarchy of animals was the lion. That's why we call the lion the king of the animals. It derives from this scheme, this medieval scheme. And so these two things were used to justify inequality in society. And it worked. And it also reflected the nature of medieval society. Because at the bottom of society, you had, for example, peasants living with off common land. They had access to common land. So they formed a community. They formed a community, and they were each responsible for the maintenance of the common land. And they had a relationship to it. They had a responsibility to it. And what was due to them actually came from their position as part of that community. So this medieval idea of plenum and everything being in its place was, in fact, reflective of the actual, was reflecting the nature of society itself. Everyone had a place. Now, the lowest of the low, the peasants, their place didn't give them very much, but it gave them something, and they were entitled to it. Now, that's quite different from what we have today in capitalism, but because we don't actually have that sense of community. So even despite in these early societies, even despite the fact that they were stratified, what we would call divided into classes, there was a sense of communal obligation and communal right, which we no longer have. So, what happened after that? Well, something changed, and it changed in the 17th century. And for the moment, put a pin in that century. Yeah, it changed in the 17th century, and we need to ask why. But before we do, I want to just go a little bit sideways, because another part of the justification for inequality is the language of rights. The language, you need some kind of language with which to express your entitlement. And so we from a very early time, we actually developed this notion in human societies. We developed this notion of rights, rights to property. Yeah, rights to this, rights to that, right to property. And I think it's important to understand that there are rights, there are two different kinds of rights. There are what's called subjective rights, and there's what's called objective rights. Now, objective rights are general rights. They state what it is right to do. So, for example, you could say it is right that children should respect their parents. You can say it is right that we should bury the dead. If you're a Bible-believing Christian, you could say it is right that children who disobey their parents should be stoned to death. Basically, you could actually talk about rights in this abstract term without relating them to any particular individual. Now, subjective rights are somewhat different. Subject rights are the rights of the subject. The word subjective here is a sort of philosophical usage. It means of the subject. So subjective rights are rights of the subject, rights of the individual. I possess a right. I have the right to free speech. I have the right to clean water, and so on and so forth. It's a right that is inherent in me as a person. And this idea was completely alien to thinkers up until the 17th century. In classical times, in Greece, the Greeks talked about rights and all this kind of stuff, ad justice, ad nauseam. They talked about it endlessly. But what's interesting, and I only found this out recently, what's interesting is that in the Greek language, you cannot actually even form a sentence in the form of "I have the right to." It's just gobbledygook in Greek. You can't actually even make that sentence. And in objective rights, you're right. Yeah, well, I'm almost going to commit an error there because I can't talk about personal rights, your right or my right, because they didn't exist then. What was due to you depended on your position within the society. And this was a natural right. Yeah, it was seen to be completely natural. Your position in the society and your society's relationship to the natural world and to everything else in nature determined what was due to you. So this again was like a collective right. The rights came from your position in society as a member of a collective society. So it's not like our society now in capitalism. It wasn't like individualized and atomized. It was actually a corporate kind of society, despite the fact that it was divided into classes, despite the fact that there was exploitation, and despite the fact there was inequality and unequalness of wealth. So, 17th century, these objective rights lasted up to, again, the 17th century. Put a pin in it. What's going on in the 17th century? Well, intellectually, let's start with intellectually. People like William of Ockham started thinking, well, hang on just a minute. If rights are, if moral, our moral right comes from the order of nature, where's the room for God in this? Obviously, this idea that it's based on the order of nature can't be right, because clearly God's will must prevail. It's God's part of God's plan. So clearly our rights don't come from nature. They actually come from God. And the interesting thing about this is that they thought, okay, well, we all have souls. As everybody knows and understands, we all have souls. And our soul is in direct communication with God. And so we have individual rights from God's will. And he grants us our own will as well, because he gives us freedom of thought and freedom of action. Therefore, our rights come individually from us through our own agreement. Now, this is all very well. We may have moral equality, but what about how does that square with the fact that we live in a very unequal kind of society? And this was the problem post the 17th century to justify the inequality that we actually experience in life on the basis of moral, that we're all equal and have equal moral rights. And this is known now today in kind of political circles as arguing from the egalitarian plateau. You had to justify inequality by the assumption of equality. Now, the way they did that was quite various. It's actually quite easy to do. It's easier than you might imagine, because this moral equality that we actually have, that comes from God to our soul, it abstracts away completely from our social relations, and it abstracts away even from our own personal qualities. It's an entirely abstracted notion of equality before God and moral equality. And so it's abstract away from all the kind of conditions in which we are unequal socially. So the task for philosophers and political thinkers was just to join up the dots on this. But why did this happen? Why was this change necessary? Well, it was necessitated by the early onset of capitalism, very clearly. It's a re response to the emergence of capitalism in the 17th century. Previously, as I've said, there were communities like peasant communities which would have collective responsibility for managing the commons on their communal behalf. But with the onset of the 17th century in the UK and also in Europe, you get something that we know, of course, as the enclosures, that the peasants were continually one after the other, one kind of part of the country after the other was enclosed. So the commons were closed off, the peasants were kicked off the land, and the aristocrat or wealthy person just came in and assumed control of it, which he used for his own advantage, either legally or illegally. And this process went on and on and on, and more kind of workers were kicked off the land. And so they ceased to become part of a community, and they were individualized. And from this point on, they were landless laborers. And so their only way of getting a living, they no longer had access to the commons, they no longer had their own means of production, as we would say, they had to sell themselves, they had to sell their labor to an employer, to a farmer, and later on to a factory owner. And so they became individualized. They were instead of being part of a community, they were all individual. Yeah, individuals with an individual relationship with their employer and so on. And so this idea of having a single individual relationship through your soul with God reflected the nature of ch the changing nature of society from a more communal to a more individualistic society. So we know that's how it came about. And indeed, of course, even the capitalist is individualized because they are competing individually with all other capitalists on the market. In a competitive system, in order to survive in the market. So everything becomes individualized, and we get the whole rise of the ideology of individualism. So there are a number of responses to this, and the earliest that we know, intellectual responses to capitalism, the earliest we know is from Thomas Hobbes, Leviathan. I mean, I'm sure we all know about Leviathan. And Hobbes is often misunderstood because Hobbes took a quite interesting, used a quite interesting way of justifying inequality, which was kind of novel. he proposed that in some notional state of nature, human beings lived individually. We didn't live in a society. We all lived separately, one from another. And because we're kind of horrible, condign creatures, we were constantly at each other's throats. We were constantly fighting one another. As he put it was the war of all against all. And we got fed up with this, and we wanted something more coherent, something more orderly. So we decided that the only way that we could actually live together in peace was to set somebody up above us, possibly a king. A king, there are other possibilities in Hobbes. It doesn't have to be a king, actually, but that's the image that generally he worked with, because that was the image he understood at the time. So you need to set somebody up above us who could apply laws to keep us in check, and also people who had the power to keep the peace. So you got institutions that took control of our behavior. So what we were doing is that we were giving up our individuality. We were giving up our freedom in order to obtain peace. And this is the origin of the social contract idea. Because we were all individual beings, no longer part of a community, but individual beings, then the only way we could come together was to kind of jointly sign a contract. And so this myth about the social contract emerges. So it's a kind of functionalist argument. Functionalism has been around a while. It was very common, like, for example, in the 1930s among biologists to explain how species, kind of members of a species, each worked to preserve and to further the interests of the community as a whole. One of the interesting things about functionalism, it was very kind of keenly taken up by the Nazis and the fascists, because like it assumes this sort of coherent a society based on the state, everything, everybody contributing to it equally, part of fascist ideology. But in Hobbes's terms, it meant that, for example, the king and all the people, all his subjects and everything, and the crown and the sorry, and the and the government took power over individuals. Now, those individuals were not special. They didn't get their authority from some divine ancestor or divinely favored ancestor. They just maybe got there by accident. But the point is, it was necessary for that to happen so that people could actually keep the peace in society. So this is the way that Hobbes justified sort of inequality in society. We chose it in order that we could overcome our own natures and live in a peaceful society, or relatively peaceful society. There were other attempts at the time. There was a guy called, what's his name, Robert Filmer, I think it's Filmer, just a few years later after Hobbes. Hobbes was 1751, I remember. So this would have been about the 1780s. Filmer came along and said, look, okay, no, it's very simple. God's up there in his heaven. He gave the earth to Adam. And so Adam was the possessor of all the earth, and Adam's direct line of descent became the kings of the earth. Yeah, it's very simple. Everyone else, sort of, which is less equally kind of descended from Adam, became the nobles and so on. So incredibly simple, but incredibly similar also to the Hawaiian view, yeah, of justification. But what really happened then, the really significant event that happened then in terms of how these ideologies propagated in the modern world, is along came John Locke. Now, John Locke was not a brilliant thinker, but his idea really caught on. And John Locke took things off in a completely different direction. He didn't completely abandon the God kind of theory, but it played a very small part in what he proposed, because he wasn't concerned with a process of inequality that descended from kingship. It wasn't a political inequality. He was actually more concerned with economic inequality, which was kind of a new idea really at this time. And so what he did was he said, okay, what happened was this. In a state of nature, we go back to nature, human beings kind of faced this completely empty continent. Now, there was nothing there. It was just wild. It was unhumanized. And they took control of it. And his image actually was America, the discovery of America. And for him, it was just an empty continent. The Native Americans really didn't count. I mean, they didn't claim possession of the land, so really they were just unimportant. So his idea was that the colonists went over to America, and they went and they saw the land and the land needing improving, and the individual original appropriator started to dig the land and improve the land. Now, what was he doing by doing that? Well, the theory is God possesses us. This is where God still comes in. God possesses us. So he gives us the right of possession. We possess ourselves and we possess our labor. So by laboring on the land, we mix our labor with the land, and the land therefore becomes our property. And it is a heritable and a tradable property. So our children can inherit it from us, or we can trade it sideways to somebody else in a legitimate way. So in Locke's notion, the situation today is that those people who own land are the descendants or the result of trades between themselves and this original appropriator. So you can see how analogous this actually is to the religious idea. So instead of, sort of a divine, an ancestor who is divinely favored, we have the original appropriator. And it's a very similar sort of pattern of thought. And what the significance of this in Locke was that for the first time, people began to think that justification of economic equality had to be different. You needed a different justification from political equality, in terms of control of society through the state. And this idea became very, very popular and is still extremely popular today on the right wing. So if you discuss with right wingers today, you will very often come across Lockeans. The theory is much more elaborate than I've explained, but that's basically the essence of it. So the Lockeans today will say, as Locke did, you may object, sorry, you may object that, well, I mean, it's a bit of a fantasy, the idea that, all the way back generation by generation that the land passed down father to son, or was traded sideways or whatever, legitimately. We know that's not true because, for example, just take the Enclosure Acts, for example. The enclosures were people just being thrown off the land. There was no sort of passing down from father to son there. There was no legitimate trading. People were just thrown off the land. So we know this is not true. And the Lockeans will generally respond by saying, no, but it could have been true. And this is the Lockean argument that it doesn't really matter that it wasn't actually true. It could have been true. And therefore, it's still a legitimate argument. I mean, it's not, but that's the argument that they actually make. And so we come right up to the present now. And there are a number of approaches apart from the Lockean one. Another one, of course, is the conservative approach that goes back to Burke in the 18th century. And Burke's idea was very simple. It doesn't matter whether we can justify inequality or not, we're stuck with it. Because frankly, our present society is the result of lots of trial and error through hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, because we can only make little changes at a time, because if we make bigger changes, it's bound to be a disaster. I mean, like all other forms of ideology which tries to justify inequality, there's no evidence for this ever produced. It's just part of the mythos that people are expected to absorb. And once they have, then it's sort of lodged in their brain, and it sort of kind of does the work of justification, even though there's no evidence for it. So on the conservative view, that there is no, it doesn't matter whether it's unequal or not. We've just got to shut up and put up. But the Lockeans are on the rise now, and from about sort of late 20th century, 1980s, 1990s, an idea began to develop. It's there implicit in Locke itself, but it was never made explicit. It began to be made explicit in the 1980s, 1890s. And it goes like this. One of the main proponents of the Lockean argument these days is it Robert Nozick? I think it's Robert Nozick. And he puts the argument like this. Imagine any society you like, anything at all, doesn't matter what it is. It can be, and think about the distribution within the society. It can be equal, it can be egalitarian, or it can be according to merit, it can be according to labor, it can be according to anything you like, doesn't matter. Take any society you want with any kind of distribution, and then consider a famous basketball player. This is an American Southern story, of course. He names him Will somebody, but it doesn't matter. A famous and applauded sporting person. And imagine 1 million people want to see him perform and are prepared to put up their money to see him perform. So this sporting personality will end up with $1 million, basically. So it doesn't matter what kind of society you start with. Inequality will always result from it because of the nature of these transactions that we actually carry out between ourselves. And the only way to prevent that actually that happening is for the state or some other authority to come in and interfere with these relationships and these choices that people make to pay, for example, to see a sports personality perform. And so the state must constantly be interfering. And therefore, the state must constantly be interfering with our freedom in order to achieve this. And we must preserve freedom above all other things. So in order to preserve freedom, we must accept inequality. And that's how the argument goes. And this is an argument, if you engage with right-wing apologists, you will hear over and over and over and over and over again until my fucking head is spinning round and round and round and round. And again, it's all based upon the same idea that goes right back to the beginning, where, you know, once you trade, yeah, it's inevitable. But the point is, which is always avoided by these apologists, always, and has been avoided throughout history, is that you trade because you have a property system. It's the property system itself that is ultimately resulting in this equality. And it doesn't matter what justifications you give for it, you can't actually avoid the fact that it is all based on the nature of private property, and that we are all bound by this net of private property. So if you ever get caught up in arguments with these people, it needs to be taken back to property. The one thing, they will do anything rather than consider the notion of property. And if they try and tackle it through the notion of rights, it's like they will avoid absolutely discussing the enforcement of rights, because that's where the entire self-defeating nature of human rights actually occurs. Because human rights have to be enforced. Who are they going to be enforced by? They have to be enforced by the people who have the power and the wealth to enforce them, who are obviously going to enforce them for their own interests. And so you are going to have a power dynamic, a power relationship. So equal relationship, equal sort of human rights require a power relationship, which is a complete contradiction in terms. So, you know, I understand that international lawyers who are involved in human rights go through the most incredible hoops in order to square the circle and justify the unjustifiable. Because it's like, you know, a human right only exists if it's enforced. I mean, you know, there are people who are Platonists and who believe they're floating around in the air somewhere, you know, but a human right only actually exists if the human right is enforced. And that requires the state to agree to apply human rights. So it requires a power relationship to actually enact human rights. So that's the issue there. So the whole system is based on sand. The whole system of justification is based on sand, and it's based on the avoidance of looking at its source, which is basically property. And finally, the only other moral that I would actually draw from all this is that if somebody comes to you and tries to justify not just this, but anything on the basis of an order of nature or upon some spiritual entity, God, you know they are trying to con you. Because this is a This is a process. This is a technique that has been going on right from the beginning of sort of societies that we know about. People trying to justify something and give it a grounding that it doesn't actually have. They're trying to justify an idea which doesn't actually have a rational and empirical grounding, so that they are seeking outward to an order of nature or God to give the appearance of it. And of course, it's just sand in the fingers, basically. And I'm done.